All right. Welcome back, Seattle, to another fantastic Thanksgiving episode of The Money Seats. Nothing Thanksgiving related, just 2 days away. But anyways, I'm your host, Ross Krause, CFP, Certified Financial Planner, here to solve and answer your questions. You call in, you text in, and I'm here to answer. We're at 425-373-5527. Again, that's 425-373-5527. And you could always text me or email me, ross.krause@lpl.com, or go to my website, rosskrause.com. Become a sponsor, ask a question. Most of the questions come in. Are you guys too shy at home to call in? And today is going to be a good episode because we have a combination of both. Actually, I haven't done this before. So with me is my wife, Haley. And the reason why she's here is we barely even made it in. We had to go home real quickly for an unfortunate funeral yesterday, and flew in Sunday, got there yesterday morning, saw everyone, had the funeral, came back today, just got in, came straight from the airport here. So Haley actually had a great question that she asked in the car that I said, great, you should come in and you should ask it to me. But hold on about 10 minutes because we'll go through some text questions first, and then she'll ask her question later. And I'm just glad to be here. Like I said, been a rough week. I wasn't sure we'd make it, but glad to be here. Hope everyone's having a good week, a good Thanksgiving holiday with everyone and their family. Let's get to some questions now, because like I always say, time goes crazy here. So some of the text questions I got, the first one is, and I'm really glad I got this because I just dealt with this in my practice a few weeks ago. What to do with student loans before the repayment starts in January? Should I wait and pay normally, or should I pay off a portion of principal, etc.? The COVID relief period ends in January. So for those who aren't familiar with it, since COVID happens, a lot of people's student loans have been put on pause. And this has actually happened multiple times. It happened before. And I was supposed to resume in September. Biden then postponed it again to March, obviously to help people who are struggling with COVID and everything to not have to pay these debts. So I had a client, and they literally reached out to me a few weeks ago and said, Ross, what should I do with my – it was his exact question. What should I do with my student loans? So I'm like, great, let's set up a time to meet. Ironically enough, I've been working with this client for a while, and his first question was, can you help me with this? Which is kind of funny that – even me, and I've been working with this guy for 5 years. We meet a few times a year. He knows me well. I know his wife. It's a very intimate relationship here, as much as an advisor and a client could have. And yet they still start off with, like, can you help me with this? And it's kind of funny that people still aren't sure with advisors where they can and can't help. So if it's about money, they should be able to help you. So I just wanted to bring that up, that I usually don't get the can you help me with this. But yes, I can. About student loans. And so he sent me an email, and he showed me he had two. And essentially, it's the same thing of, oh, this sucks. I have to pay this every month. What can I do, right, when starting up in January? So we went through and we looked at it, and there were two. And a lot of it boiled down to, what's the interest rate on these loans? So we had one that was about 2.75%. And he had one that was 4.75%. So those were very different conversations. It didn't matter how much was in them, and it didn't matter if they were resuming in January or whatnot. We approached those very differently. So I know his financial situation. I know he's doing well. He likes to keep too much on cash. So we were able to quickly discuss the one and saying, you have 4.75% paying off of interest on the student loan, whether it resumes or not in January. That's a large percentage, especially now, when most interest rates are still pretty low and borrowing is still pretty low. And that for me was, well, is this bothering you? Do you have other things you want to do with the cash? Yes, that was a no-brainer. Well, let's pay this off. So he said, great, I'll call them after this. He called them after we hung up, sent me an email saying that loan's paid off. I feel great. Me and my wife just celebrated, you know, that payment. It was like a big deal. And I was like, good. The other one was a different conversation. So that was 2.75%. Your money isn't really your money has to go somewhere, right? If you have money and you have a certain amount in the bank, any excess needs to be doing something for you, whether it's invested in the market, whether it's paying off debt, whether it's spending it on frivolous stuff, whatever it is, it shouldn't just sit in the bank. It should be doing something for you to be growing or giving you enjoyment or providing value, right? That's the point of money. If you have more than you need, you got to do something with it. So at 2.75%, it doesn't make a lot of sense to pay that off early, right? Because that's extra money you're paying off that debt that you could be doing something else with. And at such a low interest rate, you're not really getting a lot of value, right? That money paying off and saving 2.75% isn't, it's just not there. So we talked and he ended up investing some in his account. We got it in the market. Yeah, the market's been down, right? That's short term. But we got it going for him. It's active. So that should hopefully answer your question. And the answer is, what is your interest rate? Have you refinanced? If it's a large interest rate, can you refinance? And if so, that might be your solution. If it's a large interest rate, do you have extra cash to pay it down? If so, then yes, I would, right? If it's a small interest rate and you're just, you know, I have to pay this every month, you're probably better off investing it. Now, I had the conversation, and we can have these conversations all we want, but if you don't actually do the investing with it and you just keep it in the bank and wait and wait and wait and wait for a good time, then that's obviously not going to help. So make sure you take action, right? I'm going to tell here and say, if you have a low interest rate, invest the money. And you might be like, yeah, that's a good idea, but do it, right? If you don't do it, then that defeats the purpose and you are better off paying it off. So those would be my recommendations. Those are something you could easily look at, right? Call the loan provider, see if you could refinance, do some research about that, about refinancing. Make sure, like I said, if you have an advisor, you could pretty easily figure out how much cash you need, if you have extra, what you want to do, come up with a payment plan and all that stuff. Like I say before with everything, come up with a plan, look at all the angles, look at all these scenarios, and then make your decision based on all that information. So that's a good question. The other one I want to get to, and I have plenty more, but I don't want to keep Haley waiting, is a question about gifting. And the question was, my grandfather used to give us money for Christmas and we had to deposit it by the end of December. Why? So, yes, that's a great question. Also, that's fantastic that you got some of those gifts. So gifting is done on a year-end basis. So by the end of the year. And it's always for tax purposes. And here's why. So, and this amount changes, but right now you currently can give $15,000, that's 1-5, $15,000 every year to an individual. And if you're married, you could give 30 per person, right? So let's say your grandparent and they have 10 grandkids. And if there's two grandparents alive, they could give $30,000 if they want to each year to each kid. But it has to be done by the end of the year. And so you might be saying, well, why? Why would we do that? Well, there's two benefits of that. One is a lot of people, they who work with advisors and do all this stuff and have very thorough plans and gone through all the scenarios, have come to the realization that, and this is a good thing, is that they have more money than they need. It's a good problem to have, but it is a problem, and you need to come up with solutions for it. And so what happens if you have more money than you need? And by need, I mean, you know, no matter, you know, realistically staying with your spending habits, there's no way you're going to run out of money. You're just that above the hurdle, right? The margin for error is gone. You're going to be fine, all things considered. So there's the reason a gift then comes into one for tax reasons, you want to keep your amount under an estate. So there's an estate tax and it's very large and it changes all the time. So in the last 20 years, There was a point where there was no estate tax, meaning you could die with $1 billion and none of it would get taxed. And then there was a point where the estate tax was like $3 million a person. And the problem with that is that everything above that number, so let's say you die and you have, and the estate tax is $5 million, and you have $5 million and $1. They'll tax you on everything, up everything, all your assets, everything. So not just everything above the $5 million threshold, but it's everything to it. But if you have $4,999,999, then your tax will be zero. But if it's $5,001,000, your tax is very large. How large, you might ask? Well, anything over $1 million gets hit with 40%. 40%, yes. So if you didn't take the proper precautions, and this is why you'd gift, right? Because if you gift, then that money is no longer yours, so you can't get taxed on it as an estate. This is the federal side. So you die with $10 million, and that's part of the estate tax at the time. It's $4 million. I sure we're all charitable, but I don't think anyone wants to give that much up to the federal government. I know for a fact. If there's anyone out there who does, please call me, because you need to be commended or known. I just have to. You're like the unicorn, right? You're the great white buffalo. I just don't think you exist. But if you do, 425-373-5527, I'd love to talk to you, please. But that's just one side of it. There's a second side, and it's the state side. So Washington, I'm not familiar with, unfortunately. California, I don't think does. But Illinois has a very low one. And I just found out that it's $4 million. And that's total. So it's not $4 million for a husband and $4 million for a wife for a total of eight. It's total. It's not very much. Now, luckily, the tax is about 13%, not 40. But still, when you're approaching these numbers, you need to start gifting out to people. Because if you don't have enough people to give to, it could take a while for you to reduce that estate. If you could only do 15, you know, 20, 30, 40, 60,000 a year, right? So that's one benefit. The other big benefit, obviously for taxes, it helps because none of it's taxed as inheritance. But the other big benefit is that a lot of people foolishly make the mistake to leave everything to their loved ones and the people they care about after they're gone. And I always think that's a mistake if they've already established that they have more money than they need. And the reason why is you want to be alive and see the people around you enjoy your money. I know that seems crazy, but it's really important, I think, for most people. Jewelry, whatever you have, I just don't see the point of people holding on to stuff that they don't need and then giving it to loved ones if they could give it to them while they're alive and see them enjoy it. So that's more of a personal preference as well. So I'm a huge fan of gifting. I'm a huge fan of going through your financial plan, making sure that you already set and you have your needs and everything filled and you don't need this money. And then start doing something with it while you're alive and seeing that and making you happy. It's, you know, selfish reasons, right? You should be happy giving, right? If you're not, then it's probably not the right conversation for you to have. But most people enjoy giving, not just to make other people's lives better, but they like it themselves. And there's nothing wrong with that, to be honest. But you should do that, and you should make sure that that's kind of going on. So that's a very good question. I appreciate you asking me that, because we're in Thanksgiving, and now is the time to start doing that as well. Lastly, because I waited too long for the before I turn it over to my wife Haley for her question. Lastly, I wanted to rectify my mistake of waiting too long to address long-term care and address another big year-end thing, and it's called a backdoor Roth contribution. So there are people who, if you're single and you make about, let's say, 120 to 130-ish range, or you're married filing jointly and you make about 195 to 205, it's about the range. You could look this up and get the numbers. I'm just giving you an idea of it, not exact. You, in those ranges or above, you really can't contribute to a Roth, or you can contribute a small portion of it. And we've talked about a Roth, why it's so important. It's the one where you put the money in. You don't get any tax benefit now, but you take it out later when you're over 59 and a half, and all that's tax-free and all the earnings are. So you get a lot of value on those Roth, and doing it every year could really build up a lot of wealth that you could access without any taxes when you're 59.5, which is going to be hugely beneficial, trust me. So what is a backdoor Roth then, right? So for those people who make too much money and can't contribute, and too much money sounds like, you know, it's not too much money, it's just too much money to contribute. But in general, trust me, I work with plenty of clients who are making that amount, and they're not these insanely wealthy people, especially out here in Seattle. So it's not this exorbitant number where you're phased out of a Roth. How do you get money into the Roth? Well, you have to do something called the backdoor Roth. This is perfectly legal, by the way. It sounds like it's a loophole, which it is, but it's nothing illegal or tricky or, you know, and that can get you in trouble. So essentially what you do is you open up a regular IRA, which is like your 401k, but it's in your name, and it's just a holding account. It's just there to hold it. And you put your money in, your $6,000 if you're under 50 and an extra 1,000 if you're over 50, and then you immediately convert that to a Roth IRA. So it's a conversion. And you're like, huh, that sounds interesting. Why is that allowed and how do I do that? Very good questions. So one, it's allowed because it's not a contribution to a Roth. It's a contribution to an IRA. And you're allowed to make a contribution to an irregular IRA if you don't take the deduction. So if it's called a non-deductible contribution to a regular IRA, which is allowed no matter how much you make, because it doesn't have a lot of benefits if you don't get the tax deduction now. And then it's considered a conversion. And a conversion is something you can do no matter how much income you make. And that's a strategy I'd like to get into more at another time, because I think Roth conversions are some of the most underutilized and biggest values that people can do if they have a large net worth tied up in 401ks or IRAs or taxable money that's going to be tax deferred money that's going to get taxed when they take it out. And that's something we get to later. So that's how it's able to happen. And how do you do it? Well, for me, it's a little labor intensive. I open up and two accounts for you, link it to your bank, put it in your regular IRA, and immediately convert it to a Roth IRA. The catch is you have to have a blank account that has nothing in it. So there's a rule that I'm not going to get into, that if there's even a penny or anything in your current IRA, then there becomes this prorated percentage basis of taxes on it. And I'm not going to get into that once again because we don't have time, but you could look that up. And so it's also important that you do it immediately, because like I said, if there are any earnings, like if you put in $6,000 and waited 5 days and you earned a penny of interest, then everything gets all screwed up and becomes taxes. So it's very important to do that. So most of the time I really recommend people using a professional, because I open it, I put the money, I immediately transfer it the next day. No one's ever had an issue. You get it done. I urge people, if they're going to do a backdoor Roth, to do it with a professional. It's a lot of pain in the butt. And any little thing that goes wrong is going to have a huge consequence. So urge you to do that. You might be saying, well, is it really worth it to do $6,000? Well, if you're 30 years old and you do it every year for 30 years, yeah, that's absolutely worth it, right? If you're in your 50s and it's not that, right? So it just depends on your situation. So I wanted to bring that up because that's a year-end deadline, because you have to convert everything by the end of the year if you wanted to count for this year. Unlike a normal contribution, just so everyone knows, if you want to make a regular contribution because you fall into those income limits and you don't make too much to contribute, you have until the April tax deadline, just in case anyone was wondering. So that's something I'm going to get to later when that time comes. So now, let me introduce Haley and let her ask her question while we have about 5-10 minutes left.
Hi, so I'm Haley. I'm Ross's wife, and I'm a teacher. And question that I have is, how much is how much does it cost to have a child in this kind of? In this day and age,
yeah.
So, as things are getting more expensive.
Yeah. Basically, thinking about having a baby, what do I need to do financially to prepare for that, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. And so this came up in the car. It's not the first time, and it's common. And also, we were at the Shiva and the funeral, and of course, babies, and you're holding babies, and I'm sure that's what's on your mind, and there were two other people. So thank you for that. And I hope to address all that here. But essentially, that's a good question. I wanted Haley to ask that because she's not the only one who's thinking about that, and it's terrifying, right? Mm-hmm. So there's two types of answers to that question. The first one is, well, let's just look at the education side, right? So from an education point of view, if we're looking at college, undergrad, you inflate the cost by 18 years. Mm-hmm. It's going to sound crazy, but you're going to budget about $250,000. Whether or not you want to cover some, all, none of those costs, that's up to you, but that's a number you should budget and then discuss with your significant other and be like, okay, we're going to cover 50% or 25 or 80 or whatever it is, right? But that's the number you should start at. If you think you're just going to be grad school, you might want to throw in another 50 to 100, right? And then from there, no, that's our expense cost, okay? And you start early because once it's in 18 years, it's going to go by quickly, but also it's going to cost a lot more in 18 years than it does now. So that's that. How much then does it cost to raise? Raise the kid. So it's interesting that I said 250 for the college because that's about what it costs per kid. Sorry, for the first kid, each subsequent kid ends up being a little bit cheaper because you could do hand-me-downs and buying less stuff. But for the first initial kid, about $250,000 for the first 18 years. Now, this is assuming you're not getting support from other family members and you're going to public school, okay? If you're going to private schools and paying for other stuff, it's costing way more than $250,000, and I'm not going to give you those quotes because that's on you. If you want to spend all that private school for K-8, that's on you. That's going to cost a lot more. You'll add that to the $250,000. So that's not cheap, right? Now, it seems like a lot, but remember, it's $250,000 total over 18 years. So if you extrapolate that out, you're looking at $20,000 a year, $15,000 to $20,000 a year per kid, right? Maybe a little bit more if you're doing vacations. So we're in Seattle. Those numbers will probably be a little bit higher, to be honest. If you're in a major city where cost of living is higher, you're probably looking at more like $300 to $350 over the lifetime, as opposed to a rural place where things are cheaper, where it might be more like $150 to $200. And part of that does take into account daycare. I'm including that. So if you have a spouse who is husband or wife, husband, wife, whatever, who decides they want to be a stay-at-home parent, then that will reduce those costs, obviously. However, you have to factor in if they were working before, you're going to have a reduced income, right? So you have to take that into effect. But generally, you should reduce those costs if you're going to have a spouse that's going to be working from home. That'll save a lot of money. Also, there are plenty of people out there who work for public universities or educational institutions that get benefits for tuition and stuff. So those are things you should factor into the numbers I said. But generally, if that doesn't apply to you, keep the $250 number about where it is. And that's where you should think about where all that comes. And for most people, you'd want to do some planning. You want to do a little bit of financial planning, make sure you have a little bit of money, and see if you're going to get any help from parents, some friends, whatever that, if that's going to come or not to help you. Obviously, medical costs are a big part of that too, right? The pregnancy, trying. I'm including, by the way, the numbers I quoted are once a baby is born. If you're trying, there's an additional cost for that as well that's going to go on top of that. Yes, question.
I think it costs more to have a baby in the hospital, but if you wanted to go like a more affordable route, you could have a home birth.
Yeah, no, you're right. You can and check what your insurance covers, but that stuff is, but it's the whole like if you're having issues, and we all know people who've gone through IVF, it just, you know what happens, it's pretty normal now. Right, you want to add that to these costs. So if you're thinking about having a baby, the cost is going to be a lot different than the I just had a baby, what am I looking at? So that makes sense. So what I quoted was I just had the baby. Yay, mazel tov. Now what? As opposed to now we're thinking about having a baby. Well, $250 might not be accurate. Like I said, what type of insurance do you have? What is your work cover? Is there paid maternity and paternity leave, right? If there's not, you having less income is the same as you having to spend more, right? You could extrapolate that out as well. Do we have to go through any types of treatments and stuff to increase our chances? Like I said, insurance. So that stuff might go from 250 to 3 or 350 just based on the trying side. And that could be per kid as well. So it's daunting and scary to think about that. But people have been doing this forever, right? Most of the time what happens is you make some sacrifices. So your expenses end up going down, right? You're not eating out as much. You might not be having as much of your personal entertainment. And that's usually where that budget goes towards the baby. So the diapers, the clothes, the insurance, all that stuff that happens. So that's a big thing. I also, and I just went through this for my friends who just had a baby back home in Chicago. They were pregnant. One of the first things we discussed was life insurance. And they went ahead and got that. For those of you out there who are pregnant, who are just had a baby, work is not going to be sufficient enough life insurance for you. For 90 to 99% of the people out there. Very important that you have a conversation, you go through this. It's one of the first things I recommend new parents do is have a term life insurance. So, for example, this couple, they're in their, I think they're 30. Let's say 30, 31, both of them. Good health. They didn't get, like, the top rating, but they got the second to top rating. They got $3 million of coverage total for them for 20 years, and they're spending $100 a month. That's it. So think about it. It's not something that breaks the budget, but you need to have this. Your lives change. You're now responsible for another human being. And if anything happens to you, it's terrible. GoFundMe is not, you know, not a plan, okay? Your family shouldn't have to set up a GoFundMe place because you didn't set things up. So please, 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 anyone out there who had a baby, look at that first. It's one of the first things you do, and make sure you get that covered. It's cheaper than you think. So thanks. Great question, Haley. Thanks for being here. Happy Thanksgiving, everyone out there. I know it's going to be rainy, but you know what else is new here? And we'll see you next week for another great episode of The Money Seat with your host, Ross Krause.
Securities offered through LPL Financial, member FINRA SIPC. The opinions voiced in this podcast are for general information only and are not intended to provide specific advice or recommendations for any individual. To determine which strategies or investments may be suitable for you, consult the appropriate qualified professionals prior to making a decision. All performance reference is historical and is no guarantee of future results. All indices are unmanaged and may not be invested into directly. Economic forecasts set forth may not develop as predicted, and there can be no guarantee that strategies promoted will be successful.